When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
If you're thinking, I should go for a run today, but it looks like it could rain, Sierra says save on epic rain jackets. If you're also thinking, but I can't go out in these beat-up old running shoes, Sierra says save on top-brand running shoes. And if you're still thinking, but I'm also busy performing brain surgery, well, then we say, you really should have led with that. Sierra, let's get moving to your local store, like now. Go!
Hello and welcome to Star Diary, the podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. You can subscribe to the print edition of the magazine by visiting skyatnightmagazine.com or to our digital edition by visiting iTunes or Google Play.
Hello and welcome to the June 2021 episode of Star Diary, the monthly stargazing podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. Each month, we reveal the best things to see in the evening and sometimes morning sky over the coming weeks. I'm Ian Todd, the magazine's staff writer, and I'm joined as always by our reviews editor and practical astronomy expert, Mr. Paul Money. Paul, thanks for joining me again.
Hello, Ian. Yes, another month to come round and lots of things to see.
Yes. Do you find that the sort of lengthening days of summer are approaching and encroaching?
It's one of those things that we've always assumed that this time of year is a time for astronomers basically to sort of sit back, clean equipment, don't do any astronomy. And to me, that's beside the point. You know, there is still plenty to see because there are things like double stars and whatnot, you know, for example, you can actually observe. So they're not affected by light pollution or in actual fact, the light summer nights. And I like looking at globular clusters as well, personally. So it's one of those things that there are still things to see. And the moon is so obvious, you know. it don't matter about the light summer nights when you can observe the moon. And, of course, the moon is the guide often to many of the objects to see, such as the planets and the bright stars. Mm-hmm. So there is still plenty to see. And we've got a few planets around as well. Yeah, I don't rest during the summer. You know, and of course, our reviews never rest because we have to review equipment regardless. We just carry on. So, yeah, I was of the same opinion that I used to stop or really curtail what I did. I have to say, until I started doing the reviews. And then when you've got to do the reviews, you have to go out. And I thought, actually, this isn't too bad. Mm. I suppose the further north you are, the problem. I mean, I remember going to Scotland in the summer for a holiday with my parents, and I was just into astronomy, so I was excited, you know, going to be in the middle of nowhere, brilliant sort of thing. Of course, got up there and it was sort of like July and it was so bright the sky you couldn't see anything. There's only the moon up there, so I do feel for them in that respect, but they have got the wonderful wilds up there and sadly the midges.
yeah I can testify to that. But yeah, no, there is obviously this month in June, there is a really interesting daytime event happening on the 10th of June, which we'll obviously come to. But let's kick things off at the start of the month. What should we be looking for at the start of June?
Well, actually, it's one of those things that when the moon is near to planets at the beginning of the month, then you often find at the end of the month, it'll often repeat because obviously the lunar orbit sort of thing, 27 days sidereal motion, 29 days by the solar motion. And so the thing is sort of thing on the 1st of June, the moon, the gibbous moon is below Jupiter. So, you know, so when you look at the moon on the 1st of June, then, hey, did you realise that rhymes? Good grief, I'm a poet now. Good grief. But, you know, it's a great way to find the planets because the planets themselves, planet means wandering star, and planets often just look like a star. And if you don't follow it and see that it slowly moves against the background sky, then you can be fooled into thinking it's a particularly bright star. So having the moon as a guide is a really great way of finding the planets. So ironically, the moon was below Saturn on the 31st because Saturn and Jupiter still reasonably close. Jupiter is leaving Saturn behind now, sort of thing, after last year's fantastic conjunction. But so 31st of May, Saturn had the moon below it. And on the 1st of June, the moon is below Jupiter. But then it all repeats at the very end of the month. Now, this is the morning sky. So obviously the skies are getting lighter. So you're really looking around about 3 a.m., that sort of time. So you have to be a hardy soul to be out. Or either that or just stay up all night sort of thing, you know, and watch the glorious sunrise, the wonderful dawn sort of thing. Listen to the dawn chorus, etc. You know, the skies are often really cracking. In the morning, because the atmosphere, if it's been a nice still night, the atmosphere's settled down and you often get some of the, I've had some of my best viewing in the early hours of the morning, I have to say. So beginning of the month, first Jupiter and the moon sort of thing. And then actually on the 27th, the moon is to the lower right of Saturn. They'll be roughly south at 3 a.m. So we've got on the 27th of June, the moon is below Saturn. And then on the next night, the 28th, it's actually between. It forms a shallow triangle with Jupiter and Saturn. And then on the 29th, it's to the lower left of Jupiter. So as I say, it tends to repeat as long as they occur at the beginning of the month. But this will gradually get out of sync as we go through the rest of the year sort of thing. So it'll stop happening. So I always like it that you get two bites of the cherry, Jupiter and the moon this month.
Yeah. Are Jupiter and Saturn going to remain as morning objects for the rest of the year?
They'll stay morning objects for another month or so, but then we'll reach opposition. And the key with opposition is that's the turning point whereby they move from the morning to the evening sky. And so, you know, it's we've got to wait for oppositions for them. And I haven't got the dates to hand immediately, but it will be fairly soon, July and August for the oppositions. I think it's August, in actual fact, is the opposition date. And so, you know, they will stay in the morning for another sort of month or so. And it's a funny thing because they rise as the sun sets. So with the sun setting so late at night, it'll still feel for a few months like they're in the morning sky at their best. But later in the year, they'll move into the evening and then it'll be a lot easier. And people will notice them more because naturally the public are more perceptive of things when it's in the evening sky, when it's generally when more people are likely to be out. And of course, as hopefully lockdowns ease, people will be going out sort of thing. You'll be able to go to an observing site and hopefully perhaps public stargazing might start up again. But let's see what happens with that. We don't really know, do we, what's going to happen?
No, definitely. But we'll obviously cover that, you know, as and when, you know, in future episodes as it happens. Now, we are also looking a bit towards the inner planets, aren't we?
We are. And this is the good thing is that they're in the evening sky and still on display. We had brilliant Mercury during May. And, you know, I mean, as it happens, sort of thing, I haven't seen it because of the weather.
Classic.
It's one of the first times for ages that I haven't seen Mercury in its evening apparition. So I'm quite disappointed, I have to say. But the beauty is sort of thing that right at the end of May, Venus and Mercury were close together. So Venus is in the evening sky and so is, in actual fact, Mars. And Mars is one of those things that it's actually been slowly losing ground against the twilight. Because what you tend to find is that it manages to keep ahead for a while and stay in the evening sky, but it's losing that race now. And especially in June, you'll start to notice it because Mars will start to descend lower and lower into the evening twilight. And of course, the twilight is encroaching because it's getting towards summer with the solstice on the 21st of June. Venus is looping. It's a very low apparition for Venus, but because it's so bright, Venus is quite prominent. And again, we have the moon to guide us sort of thing. So what we've got is the moon on the 11th. Now, if you really like challenges, and I do like challenges, I like to see if this is possible to see. But on the 11th, the moon is just a few degrees to the lower right of Venus. But the moon will be 1% illuminated. It'll be an incredibly thin crescent, very low down in a bright evening sky, you know. So the key is, if you can find Venus, I would say straight away, make sure the sun set. So you're talking about half an hour after sunset. and start looking towards the northwest. And but I mean, you know, it's one of it's very ethereal seeing a really thin crescent moon. You know, sort of, it looks magical almost, sort of thing. You know, I know I'm a scientist, sort of thing, but I'm all waxing lyrical now, sort of about this very thin crescent moon. So it'd be to the lower right of Venus by a few degrees. So Venus might be a good guide to it. So if you spot Venus, search with your binoculars to the lower right, making sure the sun set, and hopefully you might pick out this very slender 1% illuminated crescent moon. Now, the next night, it gets easier because, ironically, the moon swaps sides and will be higher in the sky and on the 12th, sort of thing, up to the upper left of Venus. So, and the crescent will be, I can't remember the illumination, but it'll certainly be a lot more illuminated, but it'll still be a nice thin crescent. So if you miss it on the 11th, perhaps because of cloud or perhaps the haze is too much down below, because this is the key, you need an uncluttered, clear horizon sort of thing. It's only a few degrees above the horizon, I have to say. So the 12th is a second chance to get it as a slim crescent. And then the next night, it's next to Mars. So this sort of gives you a clue that Mars is now dropping into the evening twilight, because the gaps before were several days before the moon went from Venus to Mars. Now we're talking about just a day. So that's, you know, quite important. It shows that Mars is getting closer. And in fact, during July, Mars and Venus will actually join together. They'll be in conjunction, but very difficult. But as you say, we'll cover that next month. So 11th, 12th and 13th of June, that's when you look out for the crescent moons passing Venus first on the 11th and 12th, and then to the upper right of Mars. And it'll be a thicker crescent, so it'll be a lot easier. And hopefully you'll have a look and you'll see the Earth shine. One of those things I don't think we've mentioned before, but the Earth shine is when sort of the light is bounced off the Earth's bright atmosphere and it fills in. It's like a photographer's fill-in flash, because it fills in the night side, gently illuminates the night side. If you're on the moon, on the night side of the moon sort of thing, then what you'd see is the Earth high up in the sky, quite well illuminated sort of thing, and three quarters full probably. So a lot of light will be bathing. Should you be able to walk around on the moon and you'd be able to see what you were doing? Because you've got this moonlight, the Earth light, sorry, to actually show it. So the Earth shine is what we call it. And it so you get this wonderful crescent, which is the illumination from the sun, and you can see the ghostly rest of the moon. And I think that is just magical. So the 13th in particular will make a great photograph, catching the crescent moon as the sunlight and the Earth shine and this dot of light in the twilight, which will be Mars as well. So, you know, that's something definitely to look out for and hope we don't get clouds.
I know. That's a lovely sort of three days in a row there of really, really nice things to look out for. And you can also sort of, as you follow the positions changing over time, it really gives you a feel of the mechanics of the solar system, doesn't it? You know, sort of what's happening.
Yes, yeah, because you see real motion. And one of the things with Venus is if you watch its motion against the horizon, and especially if you use the same observing site, take note where you see Venus on the first of the month, and then watch how it slowly moves position against the horizon as it's too moving in its path around its orbit around the sun. And so it appears to move gradually to the left. So it's an interesting thing to keep an eye on, the clockwork motion of the solar system, which technically we see every month, because we see the moon going around us. So it gives us but I think it's even more important when you see the planets. And I say, with Mars dropping down to the horizon as well, sort of thing, Mars is losing that race because it's a long way from us. So it's the far side of the actual the sun. So we're losing it dropping down as the sun catches up. And of course, it's not the sun moving. It's the Earth moving around the sun. But it makes it look to us as if it's the sun moving against the background stars. But the reality is it's actually us doing the moving. Did you feel the Earth move, Ian? I know. No, of course you didn't. We don't, do we? We don't feel the turning of the Earth. We don't feel the motion of the Earth in its orbit around the sun. But watch it all closely. And when you can understand how the early astronomers were trying to struggle to figure this out.
Yeah.
You know, so it is an intuitive sort of thing. You can understand why they thought everything went round us so long ago. But it was meticulous observations of the motions, especially of Mars. sort of thing, that we actually got to understand the proper motions of the solar system.
Yeah, the interesting thing about what's happening to Mars is also, you know, it was last year that we had the incredible opposition of Mars.
It was brilliant sort of thing because, you know, it was... The closest was 2 years earlier, but it was very low for us, you know, so it wasn't at its best. And in fact, there were terrible views I had with my telescopes. But we always find in the Northern Hemisphere, for the UK especially, that, you know, 2 years later, it's further up the ecliptic. So it was up sort of like, you know, up towards sort of like Cetus and Pisces when it was at its best. So it was really well displayed. So although the disk wasn't quite as big as it was 2 years earlier, we got a really good view. But of course, now the disk is quite tiny because Mars is a long way from us now, sort of thing. You know? So gone are those days of the opposition. And we'll have to wait another sort of 15 years, I'm afraid, before we get those repeating again.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. But we're also moving on to a non-planetary object for our next entry in June's Stargazing Diary.
Now, if you like challenges, and this is a real challenge, I have to say, then the asteroid Vesta. Vesta is about magnitude 7.3, and it's been gradually fading because it was quite bright. It was almost bright as Uranus at 5.8 when it was at opposition. But it, like Mars, has slowly been losing ground. The good news is Vesta is still fairly high up, and it's in Leo. And during June, it moves under Chiron and then south of Denebola as well, sort of thing, as it moves into Virgo. Now, in the process, very early in the month sort of thing, you're looking really from the 9th to the 12th of June, it passes under the Leo triplet of galaxies. Now, the thing is, you could say it's a double challenge because this whole area of sky is now beginning to suffer from the lighter nights. So looking for 9th and 10th magnitude galaxies, you know, most people probably wouldn't bother. But I think this is a special event to at least try. And so we've got this magnitude 7.3 asteroid, this minor world sort of thing, and it's sliding underneath, and it'll be directly below Messier 65 on the 10th. So the Leo triplet is a lovely grouping of it. It's got Messier 65, Messier 66, and NGC 3628 above them. Now, that's going to be a lot harder than the two main Messier objects. I mean, they are magnitude 9 and magnitude 10 galaxies. So we are talking a bit of a challenge here. But the key is to try to leave it not too late before they've set, but late enough so that they are, although they're getting low, the sky will at least be a bit darker. The sun will be below the horizon more. So it'll give you more chance to spot the galaxies. So it'll be really interesting to see if anybody gets this. You need to be looking over towards the sort of west, about 11:30, I estimate, sort of thing, to have a go at this. So we won't have reached the summer solstice at that point. So that's the 21st. But the sky will be getting light. I mean, it's you know, already getting light. And we're recording this in late May. Mm-hmm. I already see my colleagues, my deep sky colleagues going, woe is me. We're losing the deep sky now. We're going to have to stop doing our imaging. And I'm saying, no, keep doing it sort of thing. You know, you never know what you might capture. So, supernovas could go off in galaxies. During last summer, during July, we had a supernova in M61 sort of thing, you know, and it didn't stop people imaging it. Yeah. I took an image of it sort of thing myself. So there we are. So it's a challenge. You've got this asteroid, which is visible in binoculars, I have to say. But because of the sky conditions, I suspect the galaxies will need a telescope. So round about the 9th through to about the 12th, that's when it passes below the actual triplet of galaxies. See how many galaxies, or if you can even see the galaxies. And certainly, I hope people contact the magazine if they've actually got it, because this is, I say, quite a challenge, really, to do it in such a light sky. But why not have a challenge sort of thing, you know? Hey, you know, let's have a go. Let's tease and test the old eyesight sort of to see what we can see. Because as I say, we are easy to give up on some objects sometimes because we think, oh, well, they're too low or the sky's too light. And I say, well, this is one of those times where it gives you a chance to try it because you've got a reason to. Mm-hmm. You've got an unusual, you know, say, situation with an asteroid moving below these galaxies. And when you think, I mean, I can't remember the distances of M65, 68 off the top of my head, but you are talking millions of light years. And then you're talking about an asteroid that's right in our own backyard.
Yeah.
you know, in the main asteroid belt itself sort of thing. So a complete huge difference in scale of distance.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people might be surprised to hear that you could actually see, you know, an asteroid belt asteroid. I mean, is there any hope at all for people who would like to see it just with the naked eye, without binoculars?
Not with the naked eye now. Vesta was the unusual one in that when it was at opposition, technically, I mean, because Uranus is naked eye, but you have to have very good sky conditions, dark, uncluttered, no haze. So, you know, and good eyesight as well. So there's a lot of things need to work in your favour to see sort of Vesta when it was at its brightest. It's now magnitude 7.3, so that puts it back into the range of binoculars. But if you know where the Leo triplet is, and you usually use Iota Leonis as a guide to move into that region, then, you know, you should be able to find this seventh magnitude star, extra star, amongst the normal stars of Leo. So, you know, and the thing about watching for minor planets and asteroids is basically if you get a run of clear nights, you can see which ones moved. So the stars themselves stay fixed with respect to each other. So the dot that's moving is the asteroid or the minor planet. So that's the key to identifying it. It's a little bit like some of the moons of the solar system. If you're hunting faint moons of the solar system, you hope that you get a run of clear nights one after the other. So that if you've identified the object as, say, Hyperion, Saturn, then you look the next night and if it's moved, yes, you've got it. If it's still in the same spot, sorry, you've got a star in the background. So this is the same with the minor worlds and the minor and then the asteroid sort of thing. You look for its motion. And that gives it away then over a series of nights.
Fantastic. Yeah, it is definitely worth doing that, heading out night after night, but, you know, provided the weather's, you know, clear skies. Yes. I find it even fascinating to sort of go out, you know, it's sort of easier in the winter when it gets really dark earlier, but you can go out at one part of the night and have a look at the stars, and then you go out, you know, an hour or two later and just note how they've moved, even over the course of, you know, a few hours. It's really interesting, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, yes. I mean, it's one of those things that it surprises people. So, I mean, I'm one of those that I will stay out quite a long time. And if you're looking through a telescope or imaging through a telescope, you sort of don't realise until you step back and look at the sky and think, hang on, Orion was over there and now it's like 30 degrees further across the sky. And you don't realise how much the sky has moved. And then you realise you've been out for a few hours sort of thing, you know. And you do get carried away, you know. You can get mesmerised by either the imaging or the visual observing.
Yeah.
And you lose track of time and then suddenly realise that an area of sky you were looking at that was well placed in the south is now dropping down into the southwest and even the western horizon. You think, Where did that time go?
Incredible. Okay, well, on to Mars again, I think, because it's not done yet, is it?
It isn't, and this is another challenge. And I say, quite often, we won't show these up in the magazine because they are really difficult, sort of thing, because of the light skies. But what we've got is on the 23rd, Mars actually passes right smack through the Beehive Open Cluster, Messier 44. But it will be extremely low down. It's in Cancer. This whole area of the sky is going to be light, of course. We are talking about just after the summer solstice. In fact, my observation, I would start on the 21st, but it's the 22nd, 23rd and 24th when it's on one edge on the 22nd, then it's right in the middle on the 23rd, and then it's on the other edge on the 24th. So the challenge here is that it is light nights. Whether you'll see the cluster is a real, this is the challenge. You'll see Mars. Mars is bright enough to be seen sort of thing. It'll be, you know, I can't remember the magnitude now, but it's still naked eye. So you'll be able to spot Mars. So the key is on the 23rd, look for Mars, 11 o'clock sort of thing, and look sort of, see if you can see it. It'll be only a few degrees above the horizon. This is the key, again, an uncluttered horizon. No hills or buildings or trees in the way. And if you do spot it sort of thing, then just see if you can spot any faint twinklies around in it. And that will be the cluster. And there are some really nice... I always like M44, and it's a shame we're losing it because it's got a lot of triangles in it, you know, stars making up triangles. And that always sticks with my mind, sort of look at it, there's several triangles in it that are quite prominent. So, yeah, it is a challenge this time sort of thing, but not the planet isn't the challenge, it's seeing the cluster. You know, they'll be over in the west northwest, very low down, I say 11 o'clock. And I say, I think the planet should be relatively easy enough. And certainly by then it'll be low, but you should be able to pick it up easily in binoculars. Whether you'll need a telescope so that you can improve the contrast to see the stars, that's the question. So try with binoculars. If you can't see the cluster with binoculars, if you've got a telescope, put a telescope on it. A spotting scope, even, you know, one of the things I like is I've got a spotting scope, and I used to carry around it in the car, you know, in the days when we could drive around and go out, you know, but used to reside in the car all the time. And the idea was that I had something handy that I could quickly set up. And I use it sometimes in my talks. You know, if it was clear after a talk, you know, I would actually show people, especially the public, if it's like a WI or something like that, I'd then show them the planets or the moon or whatever in it. And the spotting scope is, you know, don't just look on the birds, look at the birds, you know, and nature, use it for the night sky as well. So if you've got something handy like that, just try it. And you never know, you might see the faint sparkling of the beehive cluster. You could say, you might see those bees swarming around Mars. I just thought of that.
That sounds like a John Wyndham novel.
Yes, exactly.
That is also a good example of something that you always say, Paul, and it's using a relatively easy to find object to find a more difficult object, you know, something that's a bit more challenging. But I suppose the main event that we will probably be talking about, because it'll be the most popular event that people will be looking at in June, is sort of challenging for another reason. It'll be relatively easy to see given nice weather, but it comes with a word of caution, doesn't it?
Oh, it does. And this is June the 10th. This is the partial eclipse of the sun. Now, the thing is, you've got to be careful. You can't look directly at the solar disk because it is dangerous to your eyes. You know, you have to be very, very careful. Often we recommend using a projection method. Use a refractor to project an image onto a card. And the idea of that is you cap off the finderscope so you're not tempted to look through the finderscope because, you know, believe me, it's been done sort of thing. And it's very dangerous to look at a magnified view of the sun. I mean, the sun's bright. You don't really want to look at it in daytime directly anyway sort of thing. But so the key is you use a refractor sort of thing. And you can actually use the actual shadow of the refractor to line up on the sun sort of thing. So you don't have to look at the sun with the finderscope. You can use the telescope shadow. And when it's at its thinnest and a round circle, this is the refractor, then you pretty much know you're on target. And obviously, you can use a diagonal if you want sort of thing, but I would use straight through myself. So I have a piece of card directly behind the refractor and you'll see the image of the sun appear as you're adjusting it onto the screen. But to improve that, I'd have a screen around the front. Now, I did mention this to somebody and they turned around and said, but surely that would block the light of the sun. I said, no, you have to cut a hole in the front screen so the telescope pokes out. But the rest of the card creates a shadow zone behind the refractor. And that improves the contrast to see the bright solar disk sort of thing. So, and you never know, there might be some sunspots as well. So by projecting it, it's the safest way to do it sort of thing, to observe the sun. You could also use a colander. I don't think we own a colander. It's one of those things that we never needed. It feels so old-fashioned. I can remember one that mother used to have, sort of very, very old silver metal one sort of thing, you know. But the idea is if you use a colander, it's got lots and lots of holes in, and they create a pinhole camera. So they're like a pinhole projection. And again, you know, you put a card behind it and the colander itself acts as the shield to create the darker zone. You get all these multiple little suns actually projected. So now they will be small. So to be fair sort of thing, you'll have to wait until it's probably mid-eclipse when you actually get, you can notice the notch. But even so, it's quite something to actually see that using a simple kitchen tool like that, a colander, to actually view the eclipse of the sun, the partial eclipse of the sun.
So
and
cool.
It is partial for us, of course. But if you're up in the Arctic regions, and it's a great shame a lot of the trips aren't taking place at the moment. We're looking into them for the magazine, and many of them are not going ahead because there's so much still uncertainty about various companies allowing people into their waters to view it. But it is an annular eclipse. Now, an annular eclipse is where the moon is further away from the Earth, so therefore it's smaller than the sun. So when it goes in front of the sun, it creates this annulus of light, this ring of fire, they call it, around the sun. So, I mean, I'd love to, I've never seen, I've seen eclipses, I've seen total eclipses, but the annular I've not yet seen. So that's one of my little goals, to see an annular eclipse. But we still get a good partial eclipse sort of thing of the actual sun. And you want to be looking around about 10 a.m., I say use the projection method, but, you know, you can buy ready-made proper solar filters for telescopes. These are white light filters. They reduce the light by a factor of 99.99999%. So it lets through an incredibly tiny amount of light, so tiny it won't damage your eyesight. And so, but you must use the proper approved filters for this. You can buy the film itself, the approved film, and make your own filters as well, but they need to be nice and taut over the front end of the telescope, and then you can observe the actual eclipse progressing. So yes, it is a, we've got a daylight event, you know, so you don't have to stay up late at night sort of thing. It's daytime. Let's hope there's no clouds as usual, and it'll last until around about 12:24. So mid-eclipse is sort of like around about 11. It depends on where you are in the country, because the amount of eclipse of the sun sort of thing, it varies. So you can imagine sort of like Plymouth, where I am in Horncastle and Lerwick sort of thing. Lerwick, you know, is furthest north, and it'll see the most part of the sun actually eclipse itself. But all parts of the UK will see a big notch taken out of the sun. But I say, you really do have to be careful to observe it sort of thing to, you know, so you don't damage your eyesight. But it's nice to have something in the daytime that you can observe.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think, you know, lots of people, when they think of an eclipse, they might sort of think of the, you know, like a total solar eclipse where you can sort of during totality take a glimpse at it. But it's that idea of the fact that it's only partially obscured means that you are effectively looking at the sun. I mean,
yeah.
Where do you sort of stand on eclipse glasses?
They all work, you know, and they, I mean, again, buy them from reputable firms. I'm hoping they might still have some. I've got one or two spare myself sort of thing at the moment, so I know I've got some to use. But they're one of those things that you do have to look after them, because if they get damaged, if the speck of dust grinds onto the surface, the slightest bit of sunlight passing through them could actually do, because you don't realise it's happening. This is the trouble. You don't have pain receptors actually in the eyeball. So you don't realise you could be cooking your eyeballs. So this is why you have to be very careful and make sure they are perfect and not marked or damaged in any way. So, yes, that will give you a naked eye view. Obviously, the sun is, it's usually the size of the moon. The moon and the sun, you know, in the sky sort of thing, half a degree roughly. But I say, under this circumstance, the moon is slightly smaller than the sun. But that won't matter for our particular perspective in the UK. But eclipse glasses will still show you it. But obviously, it'll be a naked eye view. The sun will appear small, only about half a degree across on the sky. One thing you mustn't do is actually use the glasses, the eclipse glasses, and put them over binoculars thinking that'll work. Don't do that whatsoever. You need to have the objectives of the binoculars completely covered properly, sort of thing. So I would never, ever say use the eclipse glasses, because I've seen somebody try it and whatnot, and they got a reprimand from me.
Oh, right.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, it was the safety, you know.
They've
got to think safety. So you've got to stop them, you know. It's one of those things, you have to say something. You know, I said, don't do that. You will damage your eyes. It doesn't work. Because they put them on the inside, on the eye cups.
Oh, my goodness.
And the problem here is that the magnification and the focusing of the light has already taken place from the front objectives. So by the time the light hits the eyepiece sort of thing, it's highly concentrated. That's where it'll literally burn a hole straight through the eclipse glasses and within an instant.
Oh, my goodness.
So, you know, just, yeah, I've seen it done. It's frightening sort of thing. You shake your head and you're saying, no, don't do it. You know, so golden rule, don't use eclipse glasses with binoculars whatsoever. Eclipse glasses are just for the naked eye. But they will give you a good view. It's just it'll be a bit small. So this is where having proper approved filters, proper telescope will give you a much more satisfactory view of the actual progress. And again, we mentioned the clockwork of the solar system. Again, we're getting a brilliant example, aren't we? We're seeing the moon in its orbit pass partially in front of the sun. So then the clockwork motion of the solar system sort of thing, you know, on display for all to see. Yeah, you know, I think it's absolutely brilliant.
Fantastic. Yeah, yeah, absolutely fantastic. Yeah, I am personally looking forward to it. Again, you know, as we say, provided the weather holds up. But I suppose talking of bad weather and talking of clouds, there are actually, that's quite a nice segue, isn't it? There is actually...
Brilliant. I love it. Well done.
There is actually a nice astronomical cloud display, which is beginning, generally kicks off towards the end of May. Tell us all about that, Paul.
They're noctilucent clouds. These are night shining clouds. And basically, we see them after the sun has set. Now, normal clouds, when the sun has set, even in the summer, normal clouds go up, the highest clouds go up to about 5 miles high. But when the sun's below the horizon sort of thing, even in the summer, those clouds are still in darkness. And so you get the apparition whereby if you see shining clouds late at night during June sort of thing and into July, they will be these noctilucent clouds. And they're around about 50 miles up in the sky. So they're still in direct sunlight, which is why we can see them. And they're often composed of ice crystals. And so that's why they're very reflective and can be quite, you know, beautiful. And you get all sorts of patterns developing. They can be short-lived. They can dissipate very quickly. Sometimes you get a display that lasts all night. And so they gradually move from sort of like the northwest part of the sky to the north and then into the northeast, ready for the sunrise. So they are absolutely gorgeous sort of thing, you know. And I photographed one a few years ago. There's a big antenna we have not too far from us in actual fact. And it looked, this noctilucent patch looked like a dolphin. Well, I'm convinced it looks like a dolphin sort of thing, you know. Again, it's a bit like seeing shapes in clouds, isn't it, sort of thing. You start to see shapes, but they're gorgeous and there's this faint shimmering effect. And I say sometimes they're fairly static and then dissipate. Sometimes you can see them rippling and changing as you watch sort of thing. So definitely look out. This is the season for the noctilucent cloud sort of thing. It's started. I haven't seen any yet, as usual. I only saw one display last year. I was very disappointed. Several people reporting them. And I missed the display when the comet Neowise was amongst them.
Oh, fantastic.
I could have cried. I could have cried. But that's one of those things. We haven't got a comet this year, but the noctilucent clouds, you know, should be kicking off. And hopefully we'll get a decent display this year as well.
Would you recommend looking at those through binoculars or anything like that?
They are a naked eye phenomenon, but you know you can see far more structure if you use a pair of binoculars. I wouldn't bother with a telescope; it's too much magnification. But binoculars will give you a nice view, and you can examine some of the ripples that are taking place in the clouds if they're occurring, and watch the changing structure as it happens. So yes, have a pair of binoculars. But I say I think a telescope is like a sledgehammer to crack a nut sort of thing. You know, too much magnification. But 10x50s or 7x50 binoculars, that sort of thing, give you a good view and you can home in on particular bright patches and see how they're evolving during the course of the evening, sort of late night sort of thing. But you must, again, you've got to wait for the sun to set sort of thing. But you soon start to realise there's something wrong with the northern sky when the sky has got light clouds in it and they should be dark.
Yeah.
You should barely be able to see them. So, yeah, definitely worth looking out for them just in case we get some. I say, I didn't have much last year, but I'm keeping my fingers crossed this year.
Nice one. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, we started off the podcast by sort of talking about that perhaps misconception that, you know, June and July, you know, can be bad times for stargazing and astronomy and, you know, looking at the night sky. But I'm fairly satisfied that throughout the course of this episode, we've sort of dispelled that myth. What do you think, Paul?
I think we have. I mean, there is plenty to look at sort of thing. And there's lots of other little conjunctions with the moon and various stars that we haven't had time to put in as well. So there's lots to see sort of thing. It's just a case of dispelling this myth that summer is time to actually go to bed and sort of like and put your telescopes and equipment away. No. Clean it by all means sort of thing. But yes, there are things we can observe.
Indeed. Okay, well, thanks very much for joining me again, once again, Paul. And, you know, clear skies, happy observing, and I'll speak to you next episode.
Thank you very much. You take care, Ian.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Star Diary podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine, which was produced in our Bristol studio by Brittany Colley. For more of our podcasts, visit our website at skynightmagazine.com or head to Acast, iTunes, or Spotify.